Welcome to our deep dive into the Dunning-Kruger effect. You've sent us a fascinating excerpt from chapter 5 of a scholarly publication, and well, it's all about this effect. And let me tell you, it's a real eye-opener.
It certainly is. It delves into this, well, you know, this often hilarious, sometimes frustrating, world of how little we know about how much we don't know.
Exactly. And that's what we're going to explore together today, why recognizing our own ignorance is so tricky, and what this Dunning-Kruger effect really means for you in your everyday life. Get ready for some aha moments. You might even recognize some folks, or maybe even yourself, in these descriptions.
It all starts with this simple, but often overlooked fact. Ignorance is everywhere.
Okay, let's unpack that a bit. I think we tend to assume ignorance is out there on the fringes, you know, people who believe the earth is flat, or that vaccines cause autism. But this chapter suggests it's much closer to home than we think.
Absolutely. The author highlights how prevalent ignorance is even in areas we consider ourselves pretty savvy about. Science, politics, health, finance, you name it.
And he hits us with some pretty surprising statistics to back that up. For instance, did you know that only about 53% of U.S. adults know that electrons are smaller than atoms?
That's right. And get this, only about half of the U.S. adults surveyed could name all three branches of the federal government.
Wow. I have to admit, that one makes me feel a little uneasy. I mean, we all make decisions in these areas. How confident can we really be in the knowledge behind our choices if those numbers are so low? It makes you wonder, what else are we missing?
That's the crux of the issue, isn't it?
Mm-mm.
This chapter dives into the reasons why we're often so unaware of our own knowledge gaps, starting with this fascinating concept of unknown unknowns, the things we don't even know we're missing.
It's like a trapdoor we don't even see until we've already fallen through it. The author uses this brilliant analogy of new parents diligently childproofing their home. They've covered the outlets, padded the sharp corners, but have they thought of everything? Like those dangling blind cords? Yikes.
It's a perfect example of how these unknown unknowns can be lurking everywhere. We go through life feeling relatively confident, but we're surrounded by these potential blind spots. And the research examples the author provides are truly eye-opening.
Things like people misunderstanding how everyday objects work, failing to spot contradictions in what they read, it really does make you wonder, what am I missing? What blind spots are affecting my decisions and judgments?
And that brings us to the heart of our deep dive, the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Okay, so let's break this down. What exactly is the Dunning-Kruger effect? And more importantly, how does it explain this whole meta-ignorance phenomenon we've been talking about?
In simple terms, the Dunning-Kruger effect is the tendency for people with low competence in a skill to vastly overestimate their abilities. They don't just make mistakes.
Yeah.
They're often completely blind to those mistakes.
So it's not just that they're bad at something, it's that they don't even realize they're bad at it. Ouch, that's gotta be a tough pill to swallow. But I'm guessing this isn't just about those folks who are, shall we say, blissfully unaware. The chapter suggests that this effect applies to all of us to some degree, right?
Absolutely. We all have areas where we might fall prey to the Dunning-Kruger effect. And the chapter emphasizes that one of the key reasons this happens is because the skills needed to judge good performance are often the same skills needed to actually perform well.
So if you lack those skills, mm-hmm. you're not going to be able to accurately assess your own performance. That makes a lot of sense. But it's also kind of a catch-22, isn't it? How are you supposed to improve if you don't even realize you need to improve?
That's the double burden of incompetence the Dunning-Kruger effect reveals. And the research really drives this point home. The chapter even includes a graph illustrating how, across various studies, the lowest performers consistently believe they're doing way better than they actually are.
It's almost a perfect inverse relationship. The less competent you are, the more likely you are to overestimate your abilities.
Exactly. And that's what makes this effect so pervasive and potentially dangerous. Because if we're not even aware of our own shortcomings, how can we possibly learn and grow?
It's like stumbling through a task.
Those factors certainly play a role. But the research suggests they don't tell the whole story. Even when you account for those statistical flukes, the Dunning-Kruger effect still holds strong.
The author highlights a study where participants were offered money if they performed well on a task. Yet those who performed poorly still overestimated their abilities. So even with a clear incentive to be accurate, the effect persisted.
Exactly. So while other factors might contribute, the core of the Dunning-Kruger effect seems to be this fundamental inability to accurately assess one's own competence. And what makes this even more fascinating is that the effect doesn't just apply to those who are less skilled. It also impacts those at the other end of the spectrum.
You're talking about the pop performers, right? The folks who are actually really good at what they do. How does Dunning-Kruger affect them?
That's right. Interestingly, highly competent people often have the opposite problem. They tend to underestimate their abilities.
Which seems counterintuitive, right? You'd think they'd be super aware of how good they are. So what's going on there? Why would someone who's truly skilled underestimate their competence?
It's not about self-doubt or lack of confidence. Instead, they often make the mistake of assuming that everyone else is as good as they are. It's a phenomenon known as the false consensus effect, where we project our own abilities and perspectives onto others, assuming they share our level of expertise.
It's like thinking everyone must also hate Brussels sprouts, just because you do.
Exactly. And the chapter cites research showing that when top performers are given more accurate information about how others are performing, their self-estimates become more accurate as well. So it's not that they lack the ability to judge their own competence, it's that their perception is skewed by this false consensus effect.
Okay. This is all starting to make a lot of sense. But it's also a little unsettling, isn't it? Because if we can't rely on our own direct insights, and we're constantly being influenced by these biases, how do we even begin to judge ourselves accurately? What tools do we have to navigate this tricky terrain of self-assessment?
That's the question we'll explore in part two of our deep dive. Because if we want to overcome the Dunning-Kruger effect and become more competent self-evaluators, we need to understand how our minds are tricking us. And that requires digging deeper into the psychological mechanisms at play. Welcome back. We've been unpacking this idea that accurately judging our own competence is harder than it seems, thanks to the Dunning-Kruger effect.
It really is a mind-bender, isn't it? We left off talking about how even top performers can underestimate themselves due to that false consensus effect. But now I'm curious, if we don't have this clear, direct insight into our own abilities, how are we even forming these self-assessments in the first place?
That's a great question. And it's something the chapter dives into. The author points out that people don't have this magical internal radar that tells them when they're right or wrong.
So no flashing neon sign that says wrong answer?
Not quite. Instead, we rely on what the author calls indirect indicators, cues that are correlated with being right.
Mm.
But, yeah, and here's the catch, they're not foolproof.
So, it's like trying to navigate with a compass that's slightly off. You might be heading in the general direction, but you could end up miles away from your intended destination.
That's a fantastic analogy. And one of the indirect indicators the author discusses is speed. How quickly we arrive at an answer.
Ah, yes. Those snap judgments where we just know we're right because the answer popped into our heads instantly. But now I'm realizing those aha moments might be misleading us.
Exactly. Think about it. Under normal circumstances, speed can be a valid indicator of accuracy.
Because if we know something well, we can recall it easily. Like, what's 2 + 2? The answer. 4 pops into your head instantly. You don't have to think about it.
Precisely. But here's the problem. That feeling of speed and ease can also be manipulated, leading to misplaced confidence. For example, research shows that just seeing an answer, even if it's incorrect, can speed up our response time the next time we see the question. It primes our brains to retrieve that answer quickly, even if it's wrong.
It's like a mental shortcut to feeling smart, without actually being smart.
Exactly. It tricks our brains into feeling confident, even though we haven't actually learned or understood the material.
That's a dangerous combination. It reminds me of those times when I'm skimming a complex article, feeling like I'm getting the gist, until I try to explain it to someone else and realize I only have a surface level understanding.
And that feeling of familiarity can also be misleading, as the author points out. We tend to be more confident in areas we perceive as familiar. Again, there's a kernel of truth there. Familiarity often does come with greater knowledge.
Well, if I've read a bunch of articles about economics, I might feel more confident discussing economic issues, even if I'm not an expert.
Exactly. But that familiarity can also be superficial. Just hearing about a topic, seeing certain words or phrases repeatedly, can create an illusion of knowledge.
The author gives a great example of this. Imagine you see a simple addition problem, like 45 plus 56. Then you're asked to solve a multiplication problem using those same numbers. People often feel more confident about tackling the multiplication, even though it requires different skills, simply because the numbers are familiar.
It's like assuming you're a master chef, just because you've watched a lot of cooking shows. You might recognize the ingredients and techniques, but that doesn't mean you can actually execute a complex recipe.
And I think this ties into something we were discussing earlier, that idea of pre-existing beliefs and how they can influence our judgments. The chapter digs deeper into this, exploring how these preconceived notions can actually shape our experience of a task, not just our assessment of it.
That's a crucial point. Our beliefs act like a lens through which we interpret the world, and that includes our own performance. For example, the chapter describes a study where participants were given the exact same test, but it was labeled differently for different groups. Some were told it was a test of abstract reasoning, while others were told it was a computer programming assessment.
And this seemingly small change in labeling actually had a significant impact on how participants perform, right?
That's right. Those who believed they were good at abstract reasoning consistently rated themselves higher on the test, even though it was identical to the one labeled computer programming.
So, their pre-existing belief about their abilities in a certain area actually influenced their perception of the task itself. That's wild. Think about a time you might have approached a task differently based on how it was labeled. Did it affect your performance, or at least how you felt about your performance?
It's a powerful reminder that our beliefs can be incredibly influential, often more so than we realize. And this has real-world implications, especially when it comes to things like gender stereotypes and performance gaps in certain fields.
The chapter specifically mentions the persistent gender gap in STEM fields. It seems that at least part of this gap can be attributed to differing self-perceptions. Women often underestimate their science abilities, even when they perform just as well as men.
Exactly. And those beliefs can have a ripple effect, leading to lower confidence, avoidance of challenging courses, and ultimately, fewer women pursuing STEM careers. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts.
Okay, so we've got these indirect cues that can be unreliable, pre-existing beliefs that can distort our perceptions. It's starting to feel like the odds are stacked against us when it comes to accurately judging our own abilities. But the chapter also highlights another fascinating pitfall we often fall into, which the authors call the rationality trap. Can you explain what that is?
Certainly. The rationality trap refers to our tendency to seek consistency in our thinking and actions. We feel more confident when we're applying a consistent rule or approach, even if that rule or approach is fundamentally flawed.
So it's not just about what we believe, but also how we arrive at those beliefs. We can be confidently wrong if we follow a flawed process consistently.
Precisely. And in many areas of life, consistency is a good thing. Think about math or cooking. You need to follow consistent rules and procedures to get the desired outcome. But the trap lies in assuming that just because we're being consistent, we must be correct.
So the problem is that we can end up blindly following a flawed set of rules, feeling all smug and confident along the way, while actually leading ourselves further astray.
Exactly. The authors highlight research showing that people who got almost every logic problem wrong were just as systematic in their approach as those who got them all right. They were both following rules. But one group's rules were fundamentally flawed.
That's a sobering thought, and it makes me wonder, how often do I fall into that trap, sticking to a familiar process, even when it's not yielding the desired results? It really highlights the importance of regularly examining our methods and being willing to course correct, even when it's uncomfortable.
Absolutely. We need to balance that desire for consistency with a healthy dose of self-reflection, critical thinking, and a willingness to challenge our own assumptions.
It's like that famous quote, "The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results." But if we're not careful, the rationality trap can lure us into that very pattern.
Indeed. And this also goes back to the concept of those unknown unknowns we discussed earlier. If we're not even aware that our rules or assumptions are faulty, we're doomed to keep repeating those mistakes.
So how do we break free from these mental traps and become more competent judges of our own abilities? Is it even possible?
That's the million-dollar question. And it's something we'll delve into in the final part of our deep dive.
Yeah.
Because understanding the problem is just the first step. The real challenge lies in applying that knowledge to our own lives.
Welcome back to our deep dive into the Dunning-Kruger effect. We've explored how this fascinating phenomenon can lead us all astray. From wildly overestimating our abilities to blindly following flawed processes.
And how those pesky indirect cues, like the speed of recall or feeling of familiarity, can sometimes give us a false sense of confidence.
It's been quite a journey of self-discovery, hasn't it? I know I'm definitely feeling a lot more aware of my own potential blind spots, but now I'm wondering, how do we actually put this knowledge into practice? If we're naturally wired to miss our own shortcomings, how do we break free from that cycle?
That's the million-dollar question. And while there are no easy answers, the chapter does offer some valuable insights based on the research. One key takeaway is that simply pointing out people's deficits isn't always enough.
Yeah, I can imagine that going over about as well as telling someone they have terrible taste in music. No one wants to hear they're bad at something, even if it's true.
It's a natural human response.
Yeah.
The chapter highlights studies showing that people often resist feedback, even when it's presented in a constructive and well-intentioned way.
They give the example of a study where students were given feedback on their emotional intelligence. Those who scored in the bottom quartile were far less likely to want a book on the emotionally intelligent manager compared to those who scored highly.
It's like there's this protective shield around our egos. We don't want to acknowledge our weaknesses, even if that means missing out on opportunities for growth and improvement.
So what's driving this resistance? Is it all just about ego? Or are there other factors at play?
It's certainly partly about ego. It's uncomfortable to face our limitations, so we often come up with ways to protect our sense of self-worth. But the chapter suggests that there are other forces at work as well.
Like what?
Well, for one, our pre-existing beliefs and knowledge can make us less receptive to new information, especially if it contradicts what we already hold to be true. We tend to cling to information that confirms our existing views, even when that information is demonstrably false. It's what's known as confirmation bias.
Oh, I've definitely experienced that. It's so easy to fall into those echo chambers where we only surround ourselves with information that reinforces our beliefs.
And the chapter highlights some fascinating research on this, specifically in the realm of political misperceptions. They found that when a news article corrected a false claim, it only changed the beliefs of those who already agreed with the correction. Those who held opposing views actually dug in their heels and became more entrenched in their beliefs after reading the correction.
So even when presented with clear evidence that contradicts our views, we can find ways to dismiss it or rationalize it away. It's like we're all wearing these invisible blinders that filter out anything that challenges our worldview.
And here's where it gets even more interesting. The chapter argues that even accurate knowledge can sometimes hinder learning if it's not applied in a flexible and adaptable way.
How is that possible? Isn't more knowledge always a good thing?
It depends on how that knowledge is structured and applied. They give the example of experienced London cab drivers who were asked to learn routes through a hypothetical new area of the city. Their extensive knowledge of London's existing streets actually interfered with their ability to learn the new routes.
Wait, so their expertise in one area was actually a stumbling block in another?
Exactly. It's just that our existing mental models can become so ingrained that they make it difficult to accommodate new information that doesn't fit neatly into those models. It's like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole.
So it's not enough to simply acquire more knowledge. We also need to be willing to let go of outdated or inaccurate information and adapt our mental models as we learn and grow.
Precisely. And that's where the importance of critical thinking comes in. We need to develop the ability to step back from our assumptions, evaluate information objectively, and be open to changing our minds when presented with compelling evidence, even when it challenges our deeply held beliefs.
So how do we cultivate that kind of critical thinking? Are there specific strategies or techniques we can use to become more aware of our own biases and avoid falling into these mental traps?
That's a great question. And while there's no one-size-fits-all solution, the chapter does offer some practical advice based on the research. One key strategy is to actively seek out diverse perspectives and information that challenges our existing views.
So, instead of just reading news articles or opinions that align with our beliefs, we should make a conscious effort to engage with viewpoints that differ from our own.
Exactly. It's about breaking out of those echo chambers and exposing ourselves to a wider range of ideas and perspectives. This can help us identify our own blind spots and broaden our understanding of complex issues.
It's like getting a second opinion from a doctor. You might trust your primary care physician, but it never hurts to get another perspective, especially if you're dealing with a serious medical condition.
Another important strategy is to cultivate a mindset of intellectual humility. This means being willing to acknowledge that we don't have all the answers, that our beliefs might be wrong, and that there's always more to learn.
It's about embracing the unknown rather than fearing it.
Precisely. And this ties into the idea of lifelong learning. We should approach life with a sense of curiosity and a willingness to continuously challenge ourselves and expand our knowledge base.
This reminds me of something we discussed earlier, how overconfidence can sometimes be a double-edged sword. The chapter suggests that it might be helpful to distinguish between different phases of goal pursuit.
Right. They argue that overconfidence might be beneficial in the execution phase, when we need that extra push to persevere through challenges. But in the planning phase, when we need to assess risks and make strategic decisions, overconfidence can be detrimental.
So it's like the difference between a general rallying the troops before battle versus planning the battle strategy in the first place.
Exactly. There's a time and a place for bold optimism, but it's crucial to temper that with realism, careful analysis, and a willingness to adjust our plans as needed.
It seems like the key takeaway here is balance. We need to balance confidence with humility, conviction with open-mindedness, and the drive to achieve with the wisdom to recognize our limitations.
And that brings us back to Socrates, whom the author mentions in the chapter's concluding remarks. Socrates was considered one of the wisest men of his time, not because he had all the answers, but because he recognized the limits of his own knowledge. He famously said, "The only true wisdom is in knowing you know nothing."
So embracing our limitations can actually be a source of strength and wisdom.
That's the paradoxical truth the Dunning-Kruger effect reveals. The more we understand the depths of our own ignorance, the more equipped we are to navigate the complexities of the world, make sound decisions, and live a life of continuous learning and growth.
This has been an incredibly insightful deep dive. It's given me a new perspective on the challenges of self-assessment and the importance of cultivating intellectual humility and critical thinking.
And remember, the journey of self-discovery is never truly finished, but by staying curious, seeking out diverse perspectives, and challenging our assumptions, we can continue to learn and grow throughout our lives.
Well said. And on that note, we'll wrap up this episode of The Deep Dive. We hope you've enjoyed exploring the fascinating world of the Dunning-Kruger effect with us. Remember, true knowledge begins with acknowledging what we don't know.
Until next time, stay curious.